Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Tea Party activists hit the road. Will they derail before November? I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. After losing on health care reform, Tea Partiers launched a nationwide bus campaign this weekend. They started with a rally near Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid's hometown in Nevada, and they'll wind up in Washington, D.C. for a rally on April 15th. But will the Tea Party run out of steam before midterm elections this fall? After lawmakers were harassed for voting for health care reform, is Tea Party rhetoric causing problems for mainstream Republicans? On Reporter's Notebook, the president goes to Afghanistan. First, here's the news. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. We're back with Which Way LA on KCRW. We'll take a look today at the Tea Party movement and its growing momentum, with former GOP vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin calling for followers to reload and not retreat. Questions are being raised about Tea Partiers' tactics and whether their words are inciting violence. Will the frustration that's feeding the movement turn into long-term political activism? On Reporter's Notebook, Obama goes to Kabul and has tough words for President Hamid Karzai. First, this story. In Moscow today, two female suicide bombers set off huge explosions in two subway stations, killing more than three dozen people. No one has claimed responsibility yet, but Russian officials suspect terrorists from the North Caucasus region. My guest is Clifford J. Levy, Moscow bureau chief for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us the latest details as what's happened and what's known about the suicide bombers?
The death toll has risen to at least 38 people. More than 100 people were injured, wounded in these two terrorist attacks at two landmark subway stations in the Moscow metro system. As you said, the suspicion now is that they are these attacks were launched by insurgents connected to the Muslim extremists in Chechnya and the surrounding areas of the Caucasus Mountain regions of Russia. There has been no claim of responsibility at this point, but these do bear the markings of those kind of attacks, the ones we've seen in the past.
And for Muscovites, people as they were coming off those subway stations, is this what's being re-triggered here? It's been a while since there's been a major attack in Moscow.
I think what's most shocking to people is there was a sense that the insurgency in the Caucasus in the southern region of Russia had been bottled up. It was still occurring there. There were still great problems down there, but it was there. It was not here. And there had not been a major terrorist attack in Moscow since 2004. There was an attack on a train that went from Moscow to St. Petersburg, a luxury train, in November that killed 26 people. And that was certainly shocking, but there hadn't been anything in the center of the city, of the symbolic heart of Russia in several years. So this comes. This is quite startling to people. It paralyzed the city to some extent today, and of course, everyone is wondering now what may be next.
Well, and in sending a message this close to the heart of Moscow, again, the suspected terrorists. What are they trying to say? What's their challenge to the government at this point?
I mean, I think they are trying to say that you can't contain us. You can't keep us down in southern Russia. That we can bring this fight, we can bring our insurgency right to your doorstep. And it's worth noting that they not only went after these two subway stations, but they went after the Lubyanka subway station, which is in the center of the city right next to the Kremlin, and it's located right next to the headquarters of the Federal Security Service, which is the successor to the KGB. It's almost as if they wanted to send a message to the security services that they not only can come to Moscow, but they can come right to the doorstep of the FSB itself.
And are you able to determine whether there's been any change in tactics or leadership on the part of some of these movements? As you pointed out, they're in southern Russia, but that is the North Caucasus region. Is it spreading from Chechnya into those neighboring republics there?
Well, I mean, the nature of the insurgency itself is always very murky, and it's always hard to actually understand what the outlines are of the insurgency. What we know is it exists in Chechnya, in neighboring Ingushetia, in another region called Dagestan. These are generally Muslim regions, and it's really a mixture of insurgents, extremists, people who are devout Muslims. There's also corruption, clan issues that are involved. So it's actually often very complicated to figure out what the dynamic is of the attacks that occur.
You mentioned these are predominantly Muslim populations. Is there any suspected al-Qaeda connections in the region?
Well, we don't know of them at this point. I mean, there have been hints of those. There have been suggestions from the Kremlin and from the heads of the security services that al-Qaeda is involved. But there are also experts who say this is really a homegrown insurgency and it has not come under the great influence of al-Qaeda.
And what about the Russian government's response so far to the attacks? What are Putin and Medvedev saying and doing?
You know, they're saying what you would expect. Putin was on a visit to Siberia. He cut short that visit and returned to Moscow. Medvedev was in Moscow. Medvedev immediately convened a meeting of his security advisors. Putin later did the same thing. They, of course, are vowing to destroy the terrorists. Beyond that, what strict measures they'll take at this point, it's unclear. We'll probably wait to hear about those on Tuesday.
And in terms of the region itself, what shifts would you expect to see the government taking? Obviously, Muscovites are sort of going, well, it's not as calm there as we thought.
You mean in the Caucasus?
In the Caucasus, South? Sorry.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because the Kremlin, the Russian government, had all but declared victory down there by ending, in Chechnya, for example, ending the special security situation there, which had existed for many years.
I'm sorry, we have to stop here. That's all the time we have for this segment. Thank you very much. Clifford Levy is Moscow Bureau Chief for The New York Times. We'll be back in a moment on Which Way L.A.?
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
I'm Sarah Terry, back with Which Way LA. On Saturday, some 10,000 Tea Party activists descended on Harry Reid's small hometown in Nevada. They hope to help unseat the Democratic majority leader this November and to play a major role in the midterm elections. Tea Partiers have been criticized for inflammatory rhetoric that's ratcheting up political tension and which critics say has helped fuel harassment against some Democratic lawmakers. How far will the Tea Party go? How will it shape political debate? And how are Democrats and mainstream Republicans responding? My first guest today is David Weigel. He's senior reporter for the website The Washington Independent. He covers conservative politics and the Tea Party movement. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's start first with what happened over the weekend. I know you weren't there, but just this huge rally in a tiny town in Nevada of some 10,000 people. What was going on?
Well, there's a group called the Tea Party Express, which was not a latecomer, one of the first groups to get on board this bandwagon. That was a horrible metaphor mixing I just did. they're run by Republican consultants, unlike some of the Tea Party groups that don't like Republicans. And they put this together as their third tour, national tour, launched with what they called a conservative Woodstock in the desert town that Harry Reid was raised in, Searchlight, Nevada. So they brought Sarah Palin. She was the main attraction. The crowd trickled out after her speech. It was 30,000 at one point, according to them, and no one argues that it was down to around 1,000 by the time the final Republicans were on the stage. But it was just kind of another pot-clanging, hell-raising Tea Party event. This one, I was trying to think of what's new about it, but really, they're just kind of marching towards an alliance with the Republican Party more and more with every week, and this is the latest link in that chain.
Let's talk about the distinction you made there a little bit. This, you could say, was a more mainstream politically organized event or organized by people who've worked in the political mainstream. How does it differ from the sort of Tea Party, the grassroots people?
Well, they are a more officially Republican organization, the grassroots. The grassroots include lots of people who didn't vote in the last few elections, or maybe they voted for Ron Paul, or maybe they like Sarah Palin a lot, but they don't like the rest of the Republican Party. The people at the top have been working in Republican politics for a very long time. And they just saw this as an opportunity to get a crop of new volunteers, new voters, to come out and endorse their candidates. It's worked. I mean, one of the great sideshows of this event was there is a third-party candidate in Nevada, this guy Scott Ashton, who decided he was going to run as his ballot line says he's the Tea Party candidate against Harry Reid. And there were dozens of speakers denouncing Ashton and saying that he was a fake Tea Party candidate, and they all had to get behind the Republican. And that's, you know, if people looked at this as a complete revolution in American party politics, this is one of those incidents that's going to make sure it's not.
What are the possibilities for unseating Harry Reid in Nevada?
They're pretty good. He's in, actually, in some ways worse shape than Tom Daschle was when he lost his reelection bid in 2004. Nevada, he's in better shape because Nevada is a bluer state, and it's also notoriously hard to poll just because there's a huge population. I mean, it's still, despite the recession, growing faster than most other states, with a lot of people who don't show up in these polls, and they're mostly Democrats. But the polls have him about 10, 12 points down to all the Republican candidates. They do have him more competitive if a third party runs. And that's the thing here. Tea Party activists who are there at this event, the ones leading the event too, think job number one is making sure he's no longer in the Senate. That's more important than making a stand with a third party.
Were these mostly out-of-state Tea Partiers who came in?
Yeah, they were. I mean, this was a corner of the state that's pretty easy to access from Arizona. It's not that far from California. So it's mostly there's mostly out-of-state compared to a lot of the Tea Party Express events they put together. This bus goes from town to town, gets permits, and sets up an event, usually with local people. This was meant to be a big media-grabbing launch event, and I think it succeeded. It got these kind of events are catnip for conservatives and for liberal blogs and liberal newscasts, that can't get enough of Sarah Palin's gaffes. Or on the conservative side, they hear the same words and they think it's Sarah Palin's latest barb of wit or witticism.
And what about there were some reports of violence at that rally, and of course following on last week's threats and acts of violence against lawmakers that supported health care reform. What actually happened?
Well, this is something I'm watching. I mean, I didn't witness this. I mean, I'm in D.C. right now. So, but the Tea Party organizers, Andrew Breitbart among them, claim that people threw eggs at the first big painted Tea Party Express bus. You know, it's very obvious it's the Tea Party Express bus, and that there were other dark threats that were heard and not reported on. Andrew Breitbart, actually, he's the kind of conservative media mogul whose website broadcast the Acorn tapes last year, claimed that the media, by going there and walking through the crowd with big cameras and trying to get people on film, was inciting them, was being violent, or at least trying to provoke violence. So really, Tea Party folks are furious about this coverage that says their rallies, their anger at what the government's doing, have something to do with this rash of threats against members of Congress. So to push back against that, they've stopped apologizing and claiming that the real threats are the ones against them for just trying to hold a peaceful protest. The real threats are coming from allies of Harry Reid throwing things at them. And they haven't had a ton of proof for this yet, but they're kind of egging the media to cover this and to say that, Rush Limbaugh said this, the real death threat is the health care bill. The real death threat isn't whatever somebody sent to a congressman's office. And I think they're not having a lot of success in flipping that script, but this event was part of the attempt to do that.
We're talking to David Weigel, senior reporter for the website The Washington Independent. He covers the Tea Party movement. I'd like to bring our next guest in, Mark Potok. He's director of publications and information for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've just been talking with David Weigel at the end of our chat with him there about languaging in this debate and threats of violence. And even we've just heard him referring to Rush Limbaugh calling the health care reform bill a death threat. You track racist movements, right-wing movements, extremist groups in the United States of any political bent, I should say. But how would you characterize what's been happening over the past few weeks, and how would you—is it concerning?
I think it's extremely concerning. I mean, what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is the result of a lot of right-wing fear-mongering, as well as objective conditions out there. So what I'm trying to say is that there are real things going on. The demographics of this country are changing dramatically. It's coming from whites will lose their majority in the year 2050. You know, we have a black president. At the same time, the economy's in crisis, and in terms of unemployment, it seems to just get worse. Certainly in many states. So there's a lot of anger over issues ranging from the deficit to multimillion dollar bonuses for bankers who, you know, seem to be the same people to run our economy into the ground. You know, so all of these things are playing. In addition, and David might well have talked about this, but we are seeing a remarkable willingness on the part of many mainstream or ostensibly mainstream politicians and media commentators to push into the mainstream utterly false conspiracy theories, defamatory propaganda about certain groups like Latino immigrants, and in some cases kind of open veins of racism. So there's a lot going on out there, and my own view is that it's very much aided and abetted by people who ought to know better. You know, it's one thing for John Boehner to say after the gas line was cut to the Virginia congressman's house last week and what looks very much like simple attempted murder, that, you know, we really shouldn't engage in violence. But from my own point of view, it comes very much a day late and a dollar short. This is a genie that is a little bit difficult to get back into the bottle.
As somebody who tracks these trends and the way they emerge at different times in society, you've just sort of laid out a landscape of things that could that are causing frustration. I'm wondering, does this kind of rhetoric, does this kind of inflammatory languaging reflect a temporary moment, a possibly passing moment in American culture? Or, you know, at what point does something like this become a longer-term trend?
Well, I think it is probably a passing moment, taking the long view. But passing moments like these have a tendency to leave people dead, you know, like 168 men, women, and children in Oklahoma City back in 1995. You know, so what I would say overall is, look, no, I don't believe the country is headed towards outright fascism or that we're going to see a race war or any of that. I think, you know, at the bottom, again, taking the long historical view, you know, we are a country that went through 250 years of slavery, followed by a century of Jim Crow, and 40 years later, tens of millions of white people were perfectly willing and happy to vote for a black man for president. Additionally, every poll shows that each new successive generation of young people is more open to interracial marriage and relationships and so on. And that, I think, is really getting at the core of some of these issues. But what we are living through, I think, is very much a backlash period. And, you know, these are the kinds of things one sees after women get the right to vote, after the slaves are freed, not in chronological order, you know, after there's large Catholic immigration to a country that is, until that point in the 20s, dominated by Protestants, you know, after the gay rights movement makes some step forwards. All of those things produce backlashes. And at the fringe of these backlashes, although one wonders at this point how much of a fringe phenomenon it really is, comes criminal violence. And that is, I think, what we're seeing.
I'm curious, as we're talking about language and languaging here and what it leads to, what it might incite, Sarah Palin has been much discussed over the past few days for her comments or for about, you know, telling her supporters to relock and not retreat, including a website mapping, you know, sort of a targeted mapping of congressional leaders that they would like to unseat in November. And, you know, she said, well, it's just hunting terminology. You know, that's what I use. I've used it for years. But how do those comments, does that hold up? Do those comments get taken out
of
context?
Well, I mean, from my own point of view, that's just the latest nasty little thing that Sarah Palin has done, and that doesn't seem like the most egregious. You know, look, Sarah Palin, above all people, was responsible in this country for getting hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, to believe that Barack Obama and the Democrats intended to set up death panels to decide whether our grandparents would live or die to save $4 or $5 for the federal government. I mean, that is beyond a little rhetorical excess and a little political anger. That is into the realm of complete lie. And, you know, what happened as a result of those comments and the comments that followed them, as well as the decision, I guess, by Republican leaders not to repudiate those comments, was that millions of people believed this was so. So, you know, I think you see in the Tea Party movement many people who are genuinely frightened, who've been scared out of their wits by the likes of Sarah Palin. And, you know, it doesn't end there. There are many other similar kinds of things that have been said by politicians that have frightened people.
We're talking to Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center. I'd like to go back to David Weigel of the Washington Independent website, senior reporter there. Would you like to comment? I'm curious. I misspoke. Sarah Palin, of course, said reload, not relock.
Right.
We're hearing some strong comments from Mark Potok about how politicians should be stepping up and denouncing some of this. How would you respond?
I give Palin a partial credit or partial pass on this because that really is political rhetoric that everyone uses. But it wasn't a pass that Republicans ever gave liberals. If we remember in 2007, MoveOn.org ran an ad asking whether General David Petraeus would betray dash us, and the entire Democratic Party basically signed on to a resolution denouncing it. So Democrats, I think, have shown more capacity for self-reflection. I think Republicans view any story like this, any reports of blowback like this, as more example of media elitism. So they're going to dig in and fight harder. And I agree with Mark that that's really irresponsible. You don't need to operate as a political party or a politician apologizing for everything that you do that someone finds offensive. That's silly. But you should at least make more of a point of telling your supporters what are the parameters of discussion. In Palin's case, I really think, as you pointed out, informing people that the government's going to kill them if this bill passes, that's not hateful rhetoric exactly that somebody would be forced to condemn. But that is something that might have years of repercussions. People who might not have otherwise gotten quite so extreme about this bill will, because they really think it's a threat to their life. And I think that's the responsibility of politicians, not so much to watch whether they put a target on a website, but to say, well, before I go out and make this accusation, Does it motivate a anti-government activist to think that their life is in danger?
There was just news this morning that I think it was Michigan authorities had arrested Michigan men who had been planning to attack, to kill a policeman and then place roadside bombs at his funeral. Do you think that this kind of language connects to that kind of violence?
I think it does. I mean, one of the men involved in this, who went by the name Pale Horse, He one of the guys indicted today, put videos together asking patriots to come to Washington for a million militiaman march, and everyone laughed it off. But that was part and parcel of what conservatives like that were being encouraged to do by the establishment. And I just think Republicans who kind of egged on an argument against Janet Napolitano for letting this thing go out there should really look at what the parameters of debate should be, and whether or not it's fair to warn people about this sort of violence. You know, instead of indulging every opportunity for political anger, if there's a time to take a breath and not do that and dial back. I mean, hopefully that'll happen after the anger of last week.
Okay, thanks for joining us today, David Weigel, senior reporter for the website The Washington Independent. Our next guest is Tony Shreve. He's a local Tea Party organizer in Dandridge, Tennessee. He's also a member of American Patriotic Taxpayers. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been hearing a lot of conversation on the show so far about the relationship between language and some of the sort of extreme language that has been swirling around Tea Party politics. And
right.
I just would like to hear from you as a grassroots activist how you feel about language and the activism you're engaged in.
Right, yeah, and I'd like to respond to a couple of things Mark said. You know, the mainstream media has no proof of any of the accusations they're making toward the Tea Party, just like he talked about on the other side. And, you know, when they talk about this bill killing America, it is. It's taking our freedom and our liberty, and our government does not have the right to force health care on American citizens. And, you know, the Tea Party movement, I don't know if you'll remember back to the 9/12 march, there were 2 million people there with zero arrests. So, you know, I think that I almost wonder if with the brick throwing and things like that, where there's been no arrests made, if that's almost set up by the liberals. And I want to say this too, you know, the liberals and the mainstream media are making this, they're turning the races against each other. And, you know, I just can't believe what I'm hearing out of Mark's mouth over there.
I think actually that was David Weigel that was from the Washington Independent,
okay.
Who covers conservative politics and the Tea Party movement, who suggested that some of that languaging was a bit too violent.
Well,
we didn't hear that from Mark.
Well, what
Kotak.
It comes down to is, you know, the Tea Party movement is, you know, I don't think people really understand it.
Well, do tell us, what is it?
Well, you know, we want our voices to be heard. The government was set up to go from the people to the state, and the states delegate the federal government. It's going the other way around. The government is delegating us. I think that the people are frustrated, and I think they'll take their anger out in November. We always say we will remember in November, and I think that the liberals and the moderate progressive Republicans are worried because they're going to lose their seats in November, and they're going to try to put this violence off on us to try to divide us and make us look bad, when in reality we're just normal middle class, you know, Americans out here just trying to make it, and all we want to do is empower our voice and for our government to get back to the limited powers that it has, which is 18 of them, which one of them is to secure the borders, which they're not doing, and you know, that's it.
Well, how do you think is the most effective way to engage in conversation and to make your points?
Well, you know, I was up in Washington, D.C. A couple weekends ago, and, you know, we try to use our education to talk to the SEIU people that were up there. They resorted to violence. We watched the SEIU people shove ladies into bushes.
The SEIU people are?
Yeah, SEIU, the Union
okay.
people,
mm-hmm.
And the college kids that were up there shoving, you know, ladies into bushes and cussing. But, you know, what got covered was something that was supposedly said that they have no video film from. They don't have any audio of it. So I really think it's just a really desperate attempt from the left to try to make us look bad when we're the most educated people in the United States. And all we're trying to say is, you know, the government is not following our United States Constitution. They're doing things that is beyond their power, and we want it back the way it was when it was written.
I'm just curious. I think some people would challenge the idea that the government's overstepping. This was an elected government. They won clear and fair. It happens to be a Democratic government that's doing a few things differently than the previous Republican government. But why would this not be something that's part of the daily political life of America?
Well, Article 1, Section 8. 18 enumerated powers, the federal government, managing health care is not one of them. I mean, right there, you know, right. I mean, the federal government does not have the authority to force health care on the American citizens, period.
Okay.
It's a state issue, and now we're moving to the state level for the states to enforce their Ninth and Tenth Amendment to block this health care bill that's unconstitutional.
Tony Shreve, we're going to keep you in the conversation, local Tea Party organizer in Dandridge, Tennessee. I'd like to bring in another guest, James Joyner. He blogs at Outside the Beltway. Thanks for being here.
Hey, right, thanks for having me.
I just would love to hear your response to what we've been hearing from Tony Shreve.
Well, I'm glad you've got an actual Tea Party person on, because I was going to be in a strange position of having to defend the movement from, I think, a little bit too bombastic of charges from Dave Weigel and from Southern Poverty Law Center. I think that I'm not a fan of either the Tea Party movement sort of as it's sort of constituted in terms of the way the rallies have gone, the shouting matches at town hall meetings. Certainly not a fan of Sarah Palin as a leader in the party. But I think at the same time, I think a lot of the rhetoric has been overheated in opposition to the Tea Party, right? And focusing on a handful of yahoos that I think inevitably show up at protest movements, right, left, center, environmentalist, you name it. It just tends to be the nature of protest movements, that you get people who are angry about something or another, and frankly, there are some people who seem to be virtually professional protesters that have nothing else to do but to show up at these things. And, they tend to taint the movement, if that's what you're looking for, regardless of what the movement is. You know, people in stupid costumes and carrying inflammatory signs, and who, when interviewed by the press, can't articulate their positions very well because they're more visceral than they are intellectual.
So how does the dialogue get less hysterical?
It's an interesting question. I think it is... I mean, partly a function of circumstances. I think the nature of the economy right now, coupling that with trying to make major social changes, it sort of tends to prompt that sort of thing. But I think our rhetoric generally over the last 10, 15 years has trended in that direction anyway. I think it's part of the permanent campaign that we've seemed to have established in our political system, 24/7, 365 instant communication. We used to have the CNN effect, but now it's between blogs and Twitter, and everybody is pretty much constantly communicating a message, and the rapid response thing that used to be sort of a innovation of campaigns is now just the norm. And the nature of that is, I think, that inflammatory rhetoric and just sort of heated response and not much of a honeymoon period and all that sort of thing, I think, is just part and parcel of that new environment. So I don't see any hope for it ratcheting down much anytime soon.
We're talking to James Joyner from Outside the Beltway. Tony Shreve, I'd like to come back to you for a moment. Tea Party organizer in Tennessee. In this issue of dialogue and how people are heard, do you think Tea Partiers have any responsibility themselves to moderate the rhetoric so that they're heard more clearly as opposed to just in sound bites?
Well, at this point, they're not listening at all to us.
I'm listening.
I'm talking about our representatives that we sent to D.C. are not listening to us. The arrogance that they had in D.C. Was just unbelievable. I think a lot of them forget that they work for us.
Isn't that what elections are for?
Yeah, absolutely.
So my question to you is about the rhetoric and the dialogue.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, from what I heard in D.C., there was no dialogue that was inappropriate up there. Basically, kill the bill, we will remember in November. And then, of course, you had the 5,000 people get on their knees and say the Lord's Prayer next to the Capitol, which also didn't make it on the news. These are the type of people that you're dealing with. You're not in every movement, there's a fringe, okay? They have them in every group. There's always that one or two crazy people. But there's millions of people in this movement. And for the mainstream media they're just out searching for the one fringe guy that you're going to label with the whole movement. It's desperate. It comes across desperate. MSNBC, its ratings are awful. They're going to do everything they can to try to spike them. It's just desperation. Any rally that I've been to, people have been respectful. Of course, they want to have their voice heard, which it's not being heard, but they're gonna be loud and get on the bullhorns and say kill the bill. But I mean, they're not saying anything that's threatening to anybody. And as a matter of fact, I mean, look at the G20 summit. I mean, what you guys? I mean, they didn't report anything really on that. There was tons of violence.
Thank you for switching from you guys to they. That was
sorry.
That's good for dialogue in my book that we don't call each other you guys.
I'm sorry, but they didn't cover that the way, you know, that was extremely violent and obviously curved to the left. So, I mean, you know, the rallies that I've been at, there's been no arrests. I really think it's this is just a really desperate attempt from the left to try to make us look like we're crazy militia people, and we're not.
Okay.
We're just average Americans.
I'm going to hold you there for right now, Tony Shreve, a local Tea Party activist. I'd like to bring in our last guest. We have John Geer. He is, I've just lost your credit. I'm sorry, you're a historian, professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. My mistake. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, no problem.
So you've been listening to this conversation on dialogue and a particularly current political dialogue and rhetoric on this movement gathering steam, the Tea Party activists. Can you place this for us in a bigger historical context?
Sure. Well, first of all, what the Tea Party is doing is part of what our Constitution set in motion. I mean, allowing people freedom of speech, freedom to assemble. And right now it's a Tea Party movement. That's partly because the Democrats are in power. You know, 3 or 4 years ago, it was the left, so to speak, complaining about Iraq and President Bush. And this is just kind of part and parcel of American politics. And it oscillates depending on who's in power and what they're trying to change. And if you go back even further, the kind of rhetoric that's unfolded, whether it be due to the Tea Party movement or the way the media are covering it or just a few outlandish people, whatever, that the rhetoric is harsh and it's nasty and it's threatening, but it's not new.
Well,
that is that there's been lots of this type of rhetoric over the course of American history, and we're not breaking any new records here, and there's just big stakes, and the big stakes lead people to make big charges, so to speak.
I'm curious, though, about that rhetoric, which, as you point out, has marked the American political landscape. I think there was quite a sort of crazy bit of rhetoric around the American Civil War, but this is a different media time. The rhetoric is moving much more quickly through many different channels. I'm wondering if that ups the level of potential danger or violence.
Well, every era has its own medium of communication. I mean, let's go back to the early 1800s and where people would be sitting in a town, let's say, center, and somebody would be reading a pamphlet because a huge number of people couldn't even read. And so they're having somebody, a friend or a family or somebody they respect, read that document as opposed to, let's say, Bill O'Reilly or Keith Olbermann or whatever the case may be. It's not clear to me that the medium is necessarily the key part here. I mean, we have to think carefully about it. It's different, but I'm not sure if it's different in a way that accentuates one way or the other.
Really, you don't think Twitter or YouTube videos can be used to really change message or slant message?
Sure, but that's not new, and that's always happened. But I think what's really the big change in the media today over the last 20 years is that the idea that there's the media, that's just not even true anymore, that the media have now kind of disintegrated as a monolith, and that you can listen to left-wing stuff, you can listen to right-wing stuff, you can try to listen to more moderate stuff. And so that, for instance, I suspect that the my colleague, so to speak, from Tennessee probably doesn't watch MSNBC very much. And I don't necessarily blame him for that, but he can then listen to those kinds of outlets that he wants to. And that's a huge change in American politics. And so that, you know, you're feeding, the people who are listening to Twitter are very small numbers. And so we're not having, you know, huge penetration across millions and millions of people. Even the cable news shows have, you know, a pretty small audience. And so there's a lot of hyperbole here. And there's also a need to feed what many people have called the 24-hour beast. That is, you have to have something to cover because news is constantly going on. And it creates it. But, again, I'm just hesitant to make claims that it's dramatically changed everything because every medium had its own kind of constraints, and we've got to be, you know, careful. And that's trying to provide a little bit of context. But again,
okay,
if you want to listen to left-wing stuff, you can do that at right-wing. And that's what's happening in American politics today, is people are choosing out.
Okay.
Or opting out.
We're talking to John Geer, professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. Very briefly, I wanted to go back to James Joyner from Outside the Beltway. Just a brief comment as we're nearing the end of the show as to how this is going to affect the midterm elections.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. I would have said, you know, a week ago that the Tea Party movement, presumably it doesn't fracture into a separate party movement, in which case it'll be disastrous for the Republican Party. It was certainly mobilizing people who, you know, were not previously mobilized. I do wonder, though, whether real or manufactured or whatever, but these reports of violence and racial incidents involving members of Congress and spitting and so forth, if that doesn't create a backlash. I mean, I think that is something that the leadership of the Tea Party movement, to the extent that it even has a leadership, which is a different question, have some need, I think, not only for whatever moral responsibility they may have to speak out against violence, but I think as a matter of self-interest, they and Republican leaders need to be very careful to disassociate themselves from the fringes, which I do think are in fact fringes.
Okay. James Joyner, who blogs at Outside the Beltway. Very last and brief word of the show goes to Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Could you give us your final thoughts on the conversation?
Yeah, I'd just point out what your Tea Party man, Tony Shreve, had to say. What he said was that this was a desperate attempt by the left to set us up, to make us look bad. That was referring presumably to the spitting incidents and the attacks on congressmen, bricks through windows. He really accuses, he thinks the whole bricks, he said, was set up by the liberal media. I think I'd just like to point out the absurdity of that. And I'd also like to say that, while we're talking about, he said these are only, people on the fringe of the fringe of the fringe of the Tea Party world. Well, last week the founder of TeaParty.org sent out a huge email blast in which he compared all those who voted for the health care bill to national socialists. They are Nazis, people who put other human beings into ovens. I think that gives you a sense. I don't disagree with the professor. One needs only to think of Bernard Balin's work on rhetoric around the American Revolution. It was pretty white hot. But this stuff is quite extraordinary, and no one did step forward to denounce it. In fact, it was all very much portrayed, as Tony Shreve did, a great big conspiracy on the part of the left.
Well, we're going to have to end there today. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to all of our guests. That was Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center. We were also joined by David Weigel, senior reporter for the website The Washington Independent. Tony Shreve is a local Tea Party organizer in Dandridge, Tennessee. James Joyner blogs at Outside the Beltway. And John Geer is professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. President Obama made an unannounced trip to Afghanistan yesterday. He rallied the troops, and he criticized the Afghan president. That's coming up on Reporter's Notebook. We'll be back in a minute with Which Way LA. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. It was an unannounced trip that lasted only a few hours, but President Obama made the most of his time in Kabul on Sunday. He had a stern message for Afghan President Hamid Karzai about cleaning up corruption, and he rallied American troops during a visit to Bagram Air Base outside Kabul. Here's part of what he had to say to the troops.
There's going to be setbacks. We face a determined enemy. But we also know this. The United States of America does not quit once it starts on something. You don't quit. The American Armed Services does not quit. We keep at it, we persevere, and together with our partners, we will prevail. I am absolutely confident of that.
I'm joined today by Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He's a senior correspondent at The Washington Post. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to talk to you.
So this trip to Kabul, a two-point message, what was the agenda?
Well, the real purpose of this trip was the first point of all of this, which was to essentially, in a polite, diplomatic way, read Afghan President Hamid Karzai the Riot Act. since he assumed his second term in the fall, after a election that was riddled by allegations of an awful lot of fraud, Karzai, at the behest of the U.S., made a number of commitments to promote better governance, to crack down on corruption, address other types of malfeasance in the country that have been blamed as a principal reason why the Taliban has been able to gather as much strength as it has in recent years. And so the U.S. government, the Obama administration, has really been focused on trying to get Karzai's government to start taking some of these issues seriously. Unfortunately, in the view of the White House and the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, the Karzai government, and particularly President Karzai, has been very slow to act on many of these commitments. In fact, in their view, has done very little on them. And so a big purpose of this visit was for the president to make it very clear to President Karzai that he needs to move with some alacrity on these issues.
What are some of the specifics that Karzai has failed to act on?
Among them, purging senior officials who are accused of corruption, filling out his cabinet with sort of reform-minded technocrats as opposed to political cronies, taking seriously allegations of wrongdoing of the part of provincial governors and local police chiefs. You know, the U.S. military is readying a major push in the southern city of Kandahar over the next couple of months, be a large military operation aimed at essentially trying to regain control of Afghanistan's second largest city and a city that is the spiritual capital of the Taliban. A big reason why the Taliban is so strong in southern Afghanistan is because of a number of local power brokers, among them the half-brother of the president, who are accused of essentially running their own criminal enterprises in the city, running roughshod over the local population. And these are issues that the White House and the U.S. Embassy wants the president to start to tackle.
There was a time when Hamid Karzai was perceived as a sort of a great hope in Afghanistan, especially for U.S.-Afghan Afghan relations. What happened?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, he, over the years, U.S. officials believe, failed to really grow into the hoped-for leadership role that everybody had for him way back in 2002 and 2003 when he was a darling of Washington, when he came here with his, you know, his multicolored cape.
His robes and his hat.
Yes. And you know, we all saw him as perhaps the sort of the Mandela of Afghanistan. Well, what's happened is that he really has turned it out to be a rather weak and ineffectual leader. Now, Karzai's partisans would say that's because Afghanistan is riven by so many political rivalries and because his government failed to get genuine assistance from the United States in those early years to help build up its government, to help build up its security forces. And as a result, Karzai was forced to do a bunch of deals with unsavory characters to keep the country from falling apart. There is some truth to that, but there is also truth to the argument that in recent years, when given resources to professionalize the government to try to stand up to some of these warlords, Karzai has chosen not to and has chosen to essentially tolerate a degree of official corruption and rather poor governance across the country.
Let me just change the direction of the conversation a bit to say how important was the president's visit to the troops?
I mean, I don't mean to minimize that. Certainly, as the commander-in-chief going to see forces in Afghanistan now numbering about 80-plus thousand, they'll be up to about 100,000 by this summer, was vitally important. Of course, Afghanistan is the war that the president campaigned on as the good war, the war the United States must win.
And which he's getting good ratings on.
He's getting reasonably good ratings on, and he has committed 50,000 additional troops to this conflict, and he had not visited Afghanistan since he had become president. So obviously, you know, important to go show the flag, talk to those troops, let them know that their sacrifices are something that he cares deeply about, particularly as violence there has increased over the past couple of months.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us today.
A pleasure to talk to you.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran is a senior correspondent at The Washington Post. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Katie Cooper, Daryl Satzman, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.